I'm pleased to have with me today Brian Hooker, PhD, the father of a vaccine-damaged child, and the man at the center of the CDC whistleblower scandal. Brian has a PhD in biochemical engineering and is an associate professor of biology at Simpson University. Brian is not the whistleblower, but the man to whom the whistleblower came to confess his sins. But before we start talking about this, I'd like to thank you, my listeners, and encourage you to send me mail at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com, or join our Facebook page at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. I'd love to hear what improvements we can make in the show, and if you have suggestions for future guests, I really appreciate that. And don't forget to support PRN, which is a network that brings this show to you. If you want more shows like this and you want to support this show, then support PRN. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you, David. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Well, let's start at the beginning because I said at the beginning that you're the father of a vaccine-damaged child. And can you talk a little bit about that and how that got you started on your investigations of vaccination?
Sure. My son was actually was developing normally, was meeting his milestones and so forth until his 15-month vaccines, and he received three vaccinations at his well baby checkup, which was not a well baby checkup at all. He actually had an active ear infection. And it wasn't until later that we found out that that was contraindicated, that he was not supposed to be vaccinated when he, you know, was carrying around an ear infection. And so he subsequently ran a fever and, you know, fevered for probably about 3 weeks after that. And the fever spiked. And after that particular point, then we lost all language. We lost all eye contact. And by the time he was 18 months old and he was actually diagnosed with by his pediatrician at the time with autism, and then later on we found out that he had sustained, you know, we had suspected that because of the course of events after his vaccination, we had suspected that his vaccines had contributed. But it wasn't until later that we actually went to an integrative physician who showed us, you know, specifically based on my son's medical condition, how vaccines had influenced and actually caused the condition. After that, then I was as a scientist, I was very interested in the data that were coming out of the CDC and, you know, the fact that in the early 2000s, that they were doing many studies to look at the role of vaccines in the autism epidemic. And, you know, I was, as a scientist, I was calling CDC scientists as early as 2002 and 2003. And one of the scientists that I was working with was Dr. Bill Thompson, who, you know, ultimately became the whistleblower.
Right. And so what, you know, what did your... I mean, the CDC's been denying that there's any connection between vaccines and autism, but what did your research show you?
Well, my, you know, my research shows that you can take every study that the CDC has done regarding vaccines and neurodevelopmental disabilities, and they have not done that many. I mean, you know, they act like they have these this exhaustive set of publications. That's just not true. They've looked at thimerosal-containing vaccines. Thimerosal is the mercury-based preservative, and they've looked at the MMR, and that's it. They haven't looked at the other vaccines in the schedule. And when I go back and I reanalyze this information, I see, you know, significant statistical flaws, and in many, if not all cases, you can show that the data actually support a relationship between autism and vaccines.
Right, and so you've, I mean, there is other research outside the CDC that has shown some connection with autism and vaccines as well, right? There are publications.
Oh, yeah, you know, I've looked at thimerosal alone and neurological problems that are caused by thimerosal exposure via vaccines, and I've compiled over 165 papers just on that show that there is a definitive connection. 22 of those papers deal specifically with autism And then a number of those papers are epidemiology of autism, and they're completely counter to what the CDC claims. And these are not, you know, these are reputable publications, mm-hmm. reputable journals, and they're coming out of reputable institutions.
So what was the attitude of the CDC scientists towards somebody poking around asking questions about something they really wanted to go away?
Well, at first, you know, we started on a collegial basis, and I was trying to, you know, I was seeing some issues and some problems with the methods that they were proposing, and they didn't like that. And ultimately, somebody found out that my son was participating in the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, and at that point, CDC attorneys contacted me and said that I could no longer talk to CDC scientists. And they cited the fact that, you know, I was quote unquote suing the CDC, which is false. That's not true.
Yes.
And because I was suing the CDC, then I could not talk to CDC scientists because anything that they divulged, I could use in discovery.
Well, as an American citizen, don't you have a right to talk to government representatives? And that doesn't get taken away from you, does it? If there's some court action.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't get taken away from me whatsoever. But the CDC scientists then were instructed, and I got this via the Freedom of Information Act later on. They were instructed not to talk to me, so I could query all I wanted, but the CDC scientists were just not going to respond, and they did not respond for many, many years. And so between 2004 and 2013, my only recourse was to submit Freedom of Information Act or FOIA requests in order to get the information that I needed, background information, data, reports, correspondences that I used ultimately to show that the CDC was lying.
Right. And, I mean, where did you publish some of this information?
Well, the majority of the information regarding thimerosal was just published in a review article that was submitted in Biomed Research International, which is a peer-reviewed journal. It's indexed on PubMed. And so the majority, I was the first author on a paper that I had several collaborators mm-hmm. with, and we went through all the thimerosal papers, and we basically showed that you know, not only were they statistically incorrect, but that there's strong evidence of malfeasance, you know, that there was foul play in terms of how they were developing their statistics,
right.
and that their statistics were indeed designed not to show the truth, but to deceive the public.
Yes, and maybe now's a good time to read a little bit from the legal statement of William Thompson that he put on his law firm's website, which is August 27, 2014. My name is William Thompson. I am a senior scientist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, where I've worked since 1998. I regret that my co-authors and I omitted statistically significant information in our 2004 article published in the journal Pediatrics. The omitted data suggested that African-American males who received the MMR vaccine before age 36 months were at increased risk for autism. Decisions were made regarding which findings to report after the data was collected, and I believe that the final study protocol was not followed. I want to be absolutely clear that I believe vaccines have saved lives and continue to save countless lives, et cetera, et cetera. My concern has been the decision to omit relevant findings in a particular study for a particular subgroup for a particular vaccine. There have always been recognized risks for vaccination, and I believe it is the responsibility of the CDC to properly convey the risks associated with the receipt of those vaccines. So this is evidence for what you're saying of malfeasance, that the CDC deliberately withheld information that would have shown a connection between at least one group of people, African-American males, and autism after receiving MMR.
Correct. This is and this is one of the relationships. One of the reasons that Dr. Thompson was commenting on the MMR autism connection, and specifically in African-American males, was probably the most blatant example of the CDC covering up information, where the co-authors of the particular study that, you know, where these data were admitted, the co-authors came together, colluded, and decided that they would just simply omit the data, the offending data, showing that there was a relationship between the timing of the first MMR vaccine and autism in African American males.
Yes. And so when did William Thompson start to talk to you? And did he explain why he wanted to talk to you?
It was very interesting. I had not heard from anybody in the CDC from 2004 all the way up to 2013. And then in November 2013, I received a call on my cell phone. And it had a 404 area code. And I thought, well, that's...
Yes, that's Atlanta.
That's a little disturbing. That's Atlanta, and I'm not exactly sure what's going on. So I didn't really pick up. And the individual that called did not leave a message. But my curiosity got the best of me, so I called back and got this individual's voicemail, and sure enough, it was Bill Thompson.
Right.
And, you know, I had talked with Bill Thompson earlier, you know, back in 2002 and 2003.
Right.
And then, you know, ultimately I emailed Dr. Thompson. He ended up then corresponding with me via, you know, he gave me a phone call. We had a very nice, you know, cordial, very non-threatening phone conversation.
Mm-hmm.
He said that it was a mistake that he called my number. I'm not exactly sure if that's true. But, you know, then all of a sudden we started talking, and we
right.
started talking about CDC studies. And, you know, we talked to each other on, you know, probably a weekly basis. And he started to give me hints in terms of, like, you need to look at these particular data, and
right.
you need to request these from the CDC. This is how you request this information. And so all of a sudden I found that I was being coached,
right.
you know, essentially to get information and then to run statistics. You know, he knew that I had a background in statistics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was telling me what to look at, what specifically to look for. And one of the first things that I did was look at the relationship between the MMR timing, the first MMR timing in autism in African Americans. And, you know, I brought back that information to him, told him what I found, and his comment was to me, oh, you found it.
Yes.
And then this story unfolded where, you know, the CDC had originally found this particular effect. And, you know, I simply just duplicated what they did initially. And then he started sharing documents where this was, you know, this was documented. It was a strong statistically significant effect. And then he, you know, I criticized and I said, look, you know, these were not reported. These, you know, in fact, you dumbed down the data by adding this erroneous requirement that anybody in the study now had to produce a valid Georgia birth certificate.
Right, which was presumably a way to get rid of black people who are known to have less, you know, are less likely to have various forms of ID.
Yeah, what happened was that reduced the size of the overall group of individuals
right.
that were being studied by 40%. And when that happened, when you look at a smaller sample size, I mean, we started out with 1,000 individuals and we're looking at this effect. And then when you look at a smaller sample size, now we're looking at less than 600 individuals, then you lose statistical significance. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. The significant relationship went away, and there was absolutely no reason whatsoever for them to apply this birth certificate requirement.
Right.
In fact, if you go back to the original protocol that they were to follow, it said, you know, it said exactly opposite, that race was to be considered in the entire group of individuals, not just the birth certificate cohort.
Right. I mean, it's kind of ironic. This is the argument when they put on ID laws on voting. They say they just want to make sure there's no fraud, but they know that this preferentially impacts certain groups, especially poor black people who are less likely to have this. And if there was a connection between black people and MMR and autism, then this would be a really clever way, I mean, a diabolic way, a clever way to to get rid of it. But how did you get the data that allowed you to reanalyze it? Because, I mean, if you went to the published paper, then that wasn't there, right?
The data weren't there, no. What I had to do was actually there's a very simple way that, you know, by law, the CDC has to provide these data in a de-identified fashion. You know, any type of public study that is funded by a public dollars, especially if it has the force and effect of law, you know, like the vaccine schedule, then the CDC was required to hand over these data. And so Dr. Thompson coached me and said, look, if you email this particular individual and request these data and, you know, word your email it's in such a manner, then they will turn it over to you. And it I did have to fill out some paperwork and get approval by my institutional research board here at Simpson University where I work.
Right.
And that was about it. So it took about a month, and then all of a sudden I had, you know, the full data sets. They were de-identified, so there's no way I could identify patients. But I had the same data that the CDC used back in 2003, 2004.
Well, that's interesting to me because back around the end of the 90s or early 2000s, I was trying to get data on AIDS, and I was trying to get the raw data because what was published in the annual reports of the CDC was you know, grouped in certain ways. Mm-hmm. And I asked for this data with a statistician from Ukraine, of all places, and, you know, we went back and forth quite a few times, and they eventually told me that they didn't have enough staff to provide the data to me. I mean, obviously, I just didn't know how the CDC worked, and I'm sure that if I, you know, had people who knew how the system worked better, I could have got the data, which also was hiding some important things. Like what they published was published in a way that certain things were hidden. But
correct.
So you managed to get this hidden data and then publish it. I'd like to talk about the paper that you wrote in Translational Neurodegeneration because this story only gets more convoluted as time goes on. Let's talk a little bit about this. This was the MMR vaccine, which does not include thimerosal, right? There's no thimerosal.
This is the MMR vaccine, and the MMR vaccine does not include thimerosal. It's a live virus vaccine, so it really can include thimerosal.
Okay, because thimerosal is pretty toxic substance.
Right.
So has anybody asked the question of why they think the MMR vaccine, like what component of the vaccine, is it the actual virus particles? Is it like it has aluminum in it? Are there other compounds? Does anybody have any hypotheses about why this vaccine seems to be toxic in some children?
I wish that we had, you know, just a strong, lock solid hypothesis as to why it would be selectively affecting African American males. And, you know, the only thing that really came up, I did some searching around on this, you know, talked to some experts regarding this, and the only thing that came up in terms of physiological differences was the vitamin D profile. And, you know, darker-skinned individuals in the United States tend to be vitamin D deficient. In fact, there were some studies that we looked at that said that 90% of all African Americans were vitamin D deficient, and so they were not able to. You know, vitamin D is important in terms of detoxification, and so, you know, that's really the only thing that came up outside of the fact that this is an underserved population, and so, you know, you would expect that in this particular population that there would be more physiological stress. And,
right.
You know, probably, you know, more emotional stress, and that could be a contributing factor as well. But really the vitamin D connection is the only thing that I could come up with. The thing that is heartbreaking is that, you know, the CDC knew about this as early as 2001.
Right.
I had documents back in 2001.
Right.
You know, if they would have been forthcoming with this information 13 years later, we would know why.
Right.
We would understand why we have, you know, genetically susceptible populations to vaccine injury.
And maybe even without questioning the whole vaccine thing, maybe there are methods of mitigation. Like a lot of people are concerned about the sheer number of vaccines that people children are exposed to in a short period of time. I mean, maybe the schedule could be reduced for vulnerable populations, or maybe it could be spread out more, or things like that. But nobody's going to do anything if they claim there's no issue at all.
That is correct. You know, if it, either it's very difficult to get government funding to look at a relationship that the CDC claims doesn't exist.
Of the CDC, I mean, I think William Thompson said. The responsibility of the CDC to properly convey the risks associated with the receipt of vaccines. But the CDC also promotes vaccination, so this seems like a pretty big conflict of interest.
Correct. This is a huge problem and a huge conflict of interest, this is the agency that is in charge of vaccine uptake, and it's a financial relationship. The CDC buys the vaccines from the vaccine manufacturers. They spend over $4 billion a year in vaccinations, $4 billion of yours and my taxpayer money.
Right.
And then based on vaccine uptake, that's how CDC gets reimbursed. That's their reimbursement. And so if all of a sudden they're recommending that you not get a particular vaccine, then they're losing reimbursement. They have a financial conflict of interest.
Okay, so this is a big part of their budget. So explain that, how that works to me, because I'm not American, I'm Canadian, and you know, I know America doesn't have a public health care system, but why is the CDC buying vaccines? What happens to the vaccines that the CDC gets in their possession? I mean, do they give them away free to people, or do they resell them?
They resell them, and they're distributed to the state's public health department. Then the state's public health department distributes the vaccines to, local clinics, HMOs, and they also distribute the vaccines directly to healthcare providers. And so, it is the bulk of the vaccine business goes through the CDC. And so it's not distributed, you don't have individuals calling up Merck or calling up GlaxoSmithKline. Where they're getting these distributed is from their local health departments.
Well, that's something I was totally unaware of. I know that people had said that the CDC had a vested interest in the vaccines, but I didn't realize that it was so financial. I thought it was just that their role was, our job is to increase the vaccine rate to 100% in the United States. And, I mean, that's enough of a conflict, and certainly doesn't want to make the CDC say that, gee, there may be some vaccines we shouldn't be giving or certain people shouldn't have them, because that's going to reduce their statistics. But now you're saying that they're buying and reselling at a profit these vaccines. I presume that they resell them at some kind of a profit.
I can't really confirm, how they're being resold. I would imagine that they're being resold at a profit, but the CDC, at a minimum, even if they're not being resold at a profit, the CDC wants to recoup its expense.
Yeah, that's right. If they ended up at the end of the year with $1 billion worth of vaccines that nobody wanted, then that would be, even if they were selling at cost, that would still be $1 billion that they'd lost.
That's
and
correct.
That would be a big problem. So let's go to your paper in Translational Neurodegeneration. So this contained the information from the CDC regarding MMR and autism, and it was published in August, and then withdrawn. So can you first describe what's in your paper, and let's talk about what happened to it?
Well, specifically in my paper, I delineated that, that in the original publication, the CDC does report in the overall population a statistically significant effect, especially when you look at individuals that got the MMR vaccine before 36 months versus after 36 months.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I wanted to do was I wanted to winnow down on where did that effect come from. And so first I looked at males versus females, and then I looked at African-Americans versus other races,
mm-hmm.
and then finally I looked at African-American males. And what I found was that we, you know, the more that you honed in on African-American males, the stronger the signal got. In fact, that finally African-American males were 3.4 times more likely to get an autism diagnosis if they got the MMR vaccine before 36 months versus after 36 months. So, you know, it's a comparison of African-American males to African-American males, but the timing was just so important within this particular population, and this very strong statistically significant relationship stood out. And then what I found was then if I took the total cohort and I took all the African-American males out, then the effect went away. This was an exclusive effect to African-American males.
Okay, well, looking at your paper, maybe you can explain some of this. This is the summary of the results. When comparing cases and controls for receiving their first MMR vaccine before and after 36 months of age, there was a statistically significant increase in autism cases, specifically among African-American males who received the first MMR prior to 36 months. Relative risks for males in general and African-American males were 1.69 and 3.36. So does that mean that African-American males receiving the MMR prior to 36 months of age were 3.36 times more likely to have an autism diagnosis?
That's correct.
And then it says, additionally, African-American males showed an odds ratio of 1.73 for autism cases in children receiving their first MMR prior to 24 months versus 24 months of age and thereafter. So I'm a little confused by this. This is 1.73 times more likely to have an autism diagnosis if they received their first MMR vaccine prior to 24 months versus 24 months or later.
Versus 24 months or later. That's correct. And so what I did, I want to, you know, what I first saw was that there was an apparent benefit for delaying the MMR vaccine past 36 months.
Right.
And so that intrigued me, and so I wanted to look at the cutoff at 24 months. Was there an apparent benefit if you delayed the MMR vaccine to even just after 24 months? And I did see that those that got the MMR vaccine before 24 months did have a higher risk. They were, you know, the risk was 1.73. And so, you know, there was even benefit to just delaying after 24 months, and that there was an apparent problem. And this was not published, but I did later analysis that just basically showed that the window of time where you were seeing the highest risk for autism was anywhere between 12 and 18 months of age.
Right, and like you say, this if you saw this data, you would say even if you want to support continuing the MMR vaccine, you would say we're doing it too early. That we need to wait, especially with African American males. I mean, whether you just select them in particular, but this is pretty shocking, and it's at what they like to say in the military is actionable intelligence, right? I mean, you can do something when you know this, but if you don't know it, you can't do anything.
Right, you can do something when you know this. The one thing I did point out in my paper was this was a small cohort, and it was limited to metropolitan Atlanta, and so I did not recommend any changes to the vaccination schedule, you know, for African-American males. I'm not a physician, so I don't really feel comfortable doing that and making that type of recommendation. But I did say that this was an area that needed further study, that we needed to look at larger populations of African-American males, which the CDC could certainly do. They have the data to do that. So we could look at a larger population and see, indeed, if this effect exists when we, you know, look at instead of 1,000 individuals, what if we look at 10,000 individuals in a different portion of the nation? Do we still see the same effect? So we need to understand this more. And, you know, there, like you said, it's actionable intelligence. And, you know, I wasn't going to go out on that limb, but if a physician interpreted this information, then, you know, they may say, yeah, it's appropriate. We need to wait.
Right. I mean, it's if you believe in the MMR vaccine, and I have my own concerns about that, but if you believe that it's effective against measles, mumps, and rubella, then you have to weigh, okay, are we going to have an epidemic of one of those diseases if we delay things versus do we have an epidemic of autism? But it seems like the autism problem has grown so big that it's overwhelmed any problem with an epidemic of measles, mumps, and rubella, which are at extremely low levels in the United States right now.
Right.
And often when they occur, it's in vaccinated populations, so it's hard to blame the unvaccinated people for that.
Yeah, there's issues. You know, there's a whistleblower specifically for the MMR vaccine. You know, a whistleblower that's a former employee of Merck, and so you know that's a whole another story in and of itself. You know, and this particular whistleblower is not talking about autism, but they're talking about the efficacy of the MMR vaccine.
The efficacy. So we now have, I mean, what you found is there's a connection, at least in some populations, between MMR and autism, and what the other whistleblower is saying is that the data on the effectiveness of the vaccine might not be reliable.
That is correct.
Which all adds up to a pretty big problem for the CDC and the other people who promote MMR. Everybody knows what they did to that, to Wakefield, the British doctor who said that he'd found intestinal problems, if I understand it correctly, he'd found intestinal problems following MMR vaccination, which
right.
may or may not be related to autism, but
right.
obviously very serious problems.
Very serious, and the Lancet, the journal that published his original work, ended up retracting that particular paper, and then, you know, I just very recently joined the halls of the retracted.
Yes.
When translational neurodegeneration, what they did is they took my paper off of their website on August 27th and said that they were going to, review the paper further. And then I think on October 9th, they finally made the decision, it might have been earlier, to fully retract the paper.
And what were their, what did they say about the paper that said they needed to retract it?
Well, what was told to me was that I had not disclosed a conflict of interest, that I was serving on the board of directors for Focus Autism, and Focus Autism funded this work. And, you know, I went back to the journal and said, look, you know, when I received funding from Focus Autism, I wasn't on the board. You know, neither was I being considered for a position on the board of directors. So, you know, they were not paying me specifically to, you know, say one thing or the other regarding the MMR vaccine. And you know, my explanation was summarily dismissed. And then I said, look, if you're going to retract this paper, you have to give me some type of scientific basis for the retraction.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the scientific basis that they sent me, it made absolutely no sense. It just was very, very vague. And, the individual who wrote this, it seemed like they didn't have really a basis in epidemiology or any type of understanding how these retrospective studies were done.
Right, right.
And sure enough, I wrote a 10-page rebuttal. I rebutted, you know, the reviewer's comments. I felt in a very sound basis, and I proceeded to show, you know, how you can analyze these data in several different fashions, and you still get the same results.
Right.
And yet 2 days after I submitted that rebuttal, the journal came back and said, look, we're going to retract this anyway. And I never received a full explanation.
And okay, let's talk about the journal. So a scientific paper is accepted by the editor following peer review. And this was peer reviewed?
That's correct.
But was this withdrawn by the editor or was it withdrawn by the publisher?
I believe it was withdrawn by the publisher.
And this seems to be a pattern that's occurring. I follow the Twitter site Retraction Watch, and I've basically classified retractions into two classes. One class is, genuine fraud, plagiarism, you know, all the bad things that can happen with scientific papers. And it seems to me that in those cases, journals are incredibly reluctant to withdraw papers. It's embarrassing. They don't like it. And even when The authors have admitted that there's a problem. It's still very difficult. The second class of papers that get retracted are those that are some kind of a punishment for criticizing a scientific dogma. And in those cases, the retractions seem to be very swift, initiated by the publisher, and often don't really follow any kind of due process. Because surely if there was a problem with your paper that they would want, you know, to receive a report of what the issues were and then have your response, that would only be the right way to do it. But they didn't seem to want your response.
No. It was very odd the way that it happened. I've been publishing peer-reviewed scientific work for 25 years now. I have over 55 scientific publications that have been published in many different areas, and this is the first time anything like this has ever happened to me. And it was the publisher. It was not the journal itself, but the publisher of the journal that made the final decision that this journal, that this article would be retracted. Obviously, I want to make sure that the information gets published somewhere else, and that's something that I'm working on currently.
Right.
Because it's extremely important, and having a scientific publication that will codify that is also extremely important. People are waiting for that. They're looking for that particular information, and I know that my statistics will again be attacked. There's always folks that are against looking at detailed vaccine safety, and unfortunately these folks will go in and attack my statistics and talk about how I'm wrong, and there'll be a fair number of ad hominem attacks, which just happens every time every time I publish a paper regarding vaccine safety. There are a lot of internet, what we call internet trolls that come out and attack me, attack my character, in a very immature fashion, and I just kind of have to ignore it and go on.
Yeah, you seem quite calm about the whole thing. I mean, I think to a lot of people this would be devastating, but I think you understand how the system works, and it's not going to be easy.
No, this was not unexpected. I don't want to say, I fully expected this. But one of the reasons why I published this alone was I thought, I don't want other people to go down with the ship. And, I am in a position with a university that is very supportive of my position. This is a controversy even at my own university. I mean, I have colleagues that disagree with me very strongly regarding this particular issue. But I'm blessed to have a university that will give me the academic freedom and to do this type of work, and so the risks for me and losing my job were minimal, and so, but I didn't, I know of other individuals that have undergone similar scrutiny, but maybe have not had as much support from their institution. So I just chose to do this alone.
Yeah, I think that was wise, because I'm sure, I think with Wakefield's publication, although they went after him individually, it had an impact on all of his co-authors on that paper as well.
Right.
And what is the role of the mainstream media in all of this? Because to me, the CDC vaccination scandal was about as clear as you can get. You have a CDC scientist putting a statement on his lawyer's website saying we basically manipulated the data to hide an embarrassing finding. And, what's your assessment of how the mainstream media has dealt with this?
There has been almost a complete blackout when it comes to the mainstream media. And I had to laugh. There was an article on CNN's website,
right?
And the subject of the article was not the CDC whistleblower. In fact, it barely even mentioned the CDC whistleblower. The subject of the article was, we don't really have to worry about the MMR because this recent paper was retracted. And so that was, you know, the story was completely turned around. I had talked to the reporter that, you know, did that particular piece, and, you know, none of my comments, you know, none of the issues that I brought up were really brought to bear in that. There was a later piece on ABCnews.com on their website,
right,
that was, you know, I was similarly trashed.
Right.
You know, by scientists that don't know me and don't know my work,
right,
and quite frankly, were wrong. But at least in that particular instance, the reporter chose to use my comments and use, you know, a significant number amount of the excerpts from my interview. And so I was thankful for that. But you know, taking a step back and looking at the overall tone of that you know, that reporting, I just have to shake my head,
mm-hmm,
and realize that there is, you know, I think these reporters are under significant pressure not to malign pharmaceutical interests.
Well, they must be. My core interest has always been AIDS, and I know that some journalists who started to criticize some aspects of the dogmas of AIDS quickly got reined in, and they received their punishment. They got fired, they got pushed on, they got put on other assignments, you know, that kind of thing happens when you cross these big institutions and the mainstream media goes right along with it. I don't know if you're familiar with the blog Respectful Insolence. It's definitely not very respectful, but they were gloating over the retraction. But they quoted the journal's statements, and I thought this was quite interesting because, you know, it's not like the statement said anything too specific. So this is the direct quote from the journal. This article has been removed from the public domain because of serious concerns about the validity of its conclusions. It doesn't say what those are. The journal and publisher believe that its continued availability may not be in the public interest. Definitive editorial action will be pending further investigation. And then they say, and this is very close to what you said, the editor and publisher regretfully retract the article as there were undeclared competing interests on the part of the author which compromised the peer review process, which you've explained. And then it says, furthermore, post-publication peer review raises concerns about the validity of the methods and statistical analysis. Therefore, the editors no longer have confidence in the soundness of the findings. We apologize to all affected parties for the inconvenience caused. What I find interesting about this is that this pro-vaccination blogger is gloating over it, but it doesn't really say anything. Concerns about the validity of the methods and statistical analysis is hardly a detailed investigation of the problems. I mean, surely they would be a lot more specific if they really had concerns about this.
Right, right. You know, it's you know, the fact that I received, you know, these reviewer comments that were, you know, essentially scientifically indiscernible, calls into question, you know, the validity of the retraction directly. The blogger for Respectful Insolence has blogged about me a lot,
mm-hmm,
and has, you know, blogged about anybody who would question vaccine safety, and has voraciously, you know, gone after these particular individuals. And you know, I don't read this work anymore. I used to get caught up in that particular issue. There are some other bloggers that are, you know, in a small, you know, but vocal group of individuals that you know, write these particular blogs. But you know, unless somebody is going to go out and publish scientific literature that's refuting my work, I'm not really that concerned about it.
Yeah. I mean, that's it's very easy for them to gloat in a forum where they can control any responses to it, and they can say anything that they want over it. But it's interesting to me that they were gloating over a statement that really says nothing, saying, ha, this has been retracted because it's invalid, but it's like that means nothing.
Right. but they will attack anything that moves. Anything regarding me. My shirt doesn't match my pants. I have male pattern baldness, and I'm not very comely. Whatever. The types of assertions that have been made by these bloggers are almost humorous because they are so desperate. I have one of the bloggers that's associated with Respectful Insolent claimed that I was a 9/11 truther, which could be nothing further from the truth.
But so what?
This ad hominem attack, and I thought, wow, you're just so extremely desperate to throw up anything that would call into question, I guess, my character. But in the end, I just need to keep on doing what I'm doing. I would love to engage the mainstream media. There's much left to be done. There's a lot of science. There's a lot of things that the whistleblowers has revealed that needs to be vetted scientifically, and I now have the data to do that. So I'm looking forward to publishing more.
Yes.
And working with colleagues to vet my statistics, to make sure that what I'm putting out is lock solid. Will it be retracted again? I don't know.
It depends on the journal. It really depends on the journal, how much guts the journal has. Now, in the case of the publisher of Translational Neurodegeneration, do you know anything? Who is the publisher of that journal?
The publisher is a group called Biomed Central.
Which is a government organization, isn't it?
I don't know. They're not a U.S. government organization. I know that much about them.
Oh.
They're based in the U.K. They're based in London.
Oh, okay, okay.
But I did not really delve into, that directly. And there have been calls. There are people that are calling for me to sue them and to do this and that and the other. But I think my response at this particular point in time is to, find venues where this work can be published scientifically,
right,
and, go to those particular venues rather than, wasting my time with somebody that's going to, obviously bow to the pressure of the CDC and pharmaceutical companies.
Okay. I had confused them with PubMed.
With PubMed, yeah.
Yeah, which is the U.S. government, but it's actually part of Springer, which is the German, big, huge German publishing house that publishes everything.
Right. But Springer, okay, yeah.
Yeah, that brings up another whole issue, is that there's the big one in the United Kingdom that publishes a lot of journals, Elsevier. They've been involved in a number of retractions, but these publishing houses are so powerful and so centralized, and they have so many big interests that there's no way that they want to go to bat for some, individual paper. When the government says, through whatever channels they use, that this is a danger to public safety and you need to get rid of it, it's like they have so many other ties to medical research, to government research agencies, to other things, that they just don't want to offend them. So it's like, sure, we'll throw one paper under the bus, no big deal, to be able to continue with the other big profitable things that they have going on.
Right, right. There's pressure. There is, there's tremendous pressure in scientific publication. Look at the journal Pediatrics. I mean, they're standing by the results, even though the whistleblower has come out and said that, the paper that Pediatrics published back in 2004 is incorrect.
Well, actually, that's a perfect illustration of what I said. So we have a statement by an author saying that we manipulated the data and didn't follow protocol, and that paper will probably not get retracted because that goes into category one of retractions, which is data that's known to be manipulated, false, biased, plagiarized, whatever. Something, we know there's something wrong with it, it won't get retracted. But when you cross a line and criticize a dogma, the paper gets retracted, and they can't even state what the issue is. They just know that they have to retract it. That's a perfect example, which I hadn't thought of the two types. And it's right.
You have to look at them and say, okay, hey, by the way, your Semmelweis reflex is showing, and it's apparent for everybody.
Yes. And Semmelweis was the guy who said for years that doctors should wash their hands between delivering babies, and he ended up in an insane asylum. But of course, now doctors know the importance of cleanliness and hygiene when they're dealing with people's bodies.
Right. And a lot of the work of Semmelweis, a lot of his groundbreaking work, really was is now attributed to Lister. And unfortunately, it was Semmelweis who paid with his life to do this. And we have, on this whole vaccine autism issue, we have people like Andy Wakefield and Mark and David Geyer, who they really have gone after ruthlessly.
Mm-hmm.
And, I have not suffered persecution even close to what these individuals have suffered.
Yes, well, they look for leverage. And many people are quite vulnerable with their jobs, or maybe their jobs require publication. I mean, if you're a professor and you can't get published anymore, then you're not going to get good performance reviews. You're not going to get promotions, and things are going to turn sour for you. And there's going to be a lot of pressure to get rid of you. And
right.
They might find an excuse to get rid of you that has nothing to do with what you first did, but maybe you have some personal failing or something, and all of a sudden that means you're not useful anymore, and they can get rid of you. So where are things going for you in the future? Like, what are you going to be looking at and hoping to publish?
Well, I do want to get the work published for. That was retracted.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that I'm very concerned about. And there are other issues regarding that particular data set. The CDC did not just hide, the African-American male effect, but there's an effect around what's called isolated autism, children who got the autism diagnosis who didn't have any other type of pre-existing conditions. And there was a very strong effect when you look at that particular data set and that issue. And so I'm working on that, and then I have data sets that I obtained around some of the papers with the Marisol, and I'm looking at those data sets and preparing publications that will go out as well. And so I want to continue this work. There's much to go through. There was a lot of information that was shared by the whistleblower. The information has been shared, with me, not all of it, but the bulk of it has also been shared with Representative Bill Posey,
mm-hmm.
Congressman from Florida. And so, I am working with his office and would really like to go through all of the documentation, because I think that, what I've seen so far is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting that MMR vaccine does not contain thimerosal, and yet there's a lot of concerns about thimerosal, which says, I mean, one thing it says is that we can't just say that thimerosal is the problem, and if we get thimerosal out of vaccines, there'll be no problems anymore. Because I think there's a lot of components of vaccines that can cause problems. I mean, some vaccines contain, I'm not an expert, but they contain like formaldehyde, aluminum, a number of different things, as well as the fact that they contain cell cultures which may contain foreign animal cells and things like that.
Right. I mean, we do not know, and it seems like the way that the CDC has studied these vaccines is very reactive and very reactionary. Something will rise up in the press about thimerosal, so they'll study thimerosal so they can debunk all that. Then something rises up in the press with Andy Wakefield talking about the MMR, so they have to study the MMR to debunk all of that. But what about DTP versus DTaP? What about the birth hepatitis B vaccine that children are getting, in infant mortality rates? There's so many things that they just have not studied because they're not proactive, they're reactive.
And really, for an individual, you cannot rely on the CDC to provide honest information. So if you have concerns about whether your child should be getting vaccinated and how many vaccines, then you're on your own. Like, you're not going to, you can't phone up the CDC and say, you know, should I worry about this? Because they'll say, no, there's nothing to worry about.
They will not go out on that limb. They will not say, they'll say, tell you that it's absolutely safe. And, you know, if you ask them about autism, then they'll say that, you know, that's been debunked. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but what I've told parents who are choosing to vaccinate is to make sure that they look at the complete packet insert, that they look at all the packet insert. And right. So, you know, they know, understand the risks that they are taking when, you know, they vaccinate a child. I also want to make sure that those individuals are informed and they understand that vaccination doesn't necessarily mean immunization. When you get a vaccination, it doesn't mean, or your child gets a vaccination, it doesn't mean that they're acquiring immunity to that particular disease.
Right, which of course is what they imply, because if you don't get vaccinated, you're going to cause an epidemic. If everybody does what you're doing, we're going to get back to the epidemics of the 1800s, which is pretty well a fairy tale. But to think, I mean, with the measles, they said it was one vaccine that would be lifetime immunity when I was a kid, when it first came out, and then it was two
Correct.
Vaccines, and even then, I don't think they're claiming that it's lifetime immunity. Things have changed a lot.
Absolutely. You know, And we're seeing, like you said, epidemics in these vaccinated populations. And one of the other things that you have to turn to are countries that vaccinate much less than we do. I mean,
yes.
you look at the Scandinavian countries, you look at France, and they vaccinate, you know, they have less than half of the vaccines that we have in our schedule.
Right.
In the case of Iceland, they have less than a quarter of the vaccines
right.
that we have on our schedule, and yet you don't see these outbreaks of all these horrible infectious diseases coming back and
right.
ravaging their populations.
Yes.
And so, you know, what we're following is basically a fallacy.
Right. Well, we've come to the end of our time, so I would just like to thank you so much for sharing the hour with me and so much information, which I think will really help people in doing their own thinking and investigation about vaccination. So thank you very much.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be on your show, and I appreciate what you're doing.
Well, thank you. And thanks to the audience for listening, and goodbye.